coming up on today's Call Me Catholic Show.
Well, are you playing the trumpet and dancing at the same time?
I was tap dancing.
Wow.
Yes, I know. I couldn't do that now, but...
Dismiss all anxiety from your mind and enter into the Call Me Catholic Show with your host, Peggy Normandin.
Whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is gracious, if there is any excellence and if there is anything worthy of praise, well, I'm going to try to get to it this hour. I'm Peggy Normandin, and you have arrived at the Call Me Catholic Show, where we celebrate, explore, and affirm our Catholic identity so we can wake up and say to the world each and every day, oh, yeah, you can call me Catholic. I am in the studio with my faithful engineer, Jimmy G, the best in the business. Morning, Jimmy.
Oh, thank you very much. That was very nice of you.
Well, you know, I got to keep you happy over there.
Even though it's not true.
Oh, it is true. It is true. We are coming to you from the Tower of Hope on the beautiful Christ Cathedral campus in Garden Grove. And it is a beautiful campus. I mean, it's literally shimmering out there today. It's such a bright and sunny summer day.
It really is. It's gorgeous. And I really welcome folks to come out and visit, especially when the cathedral reopens.
Yes. Oh, it's even before that time. There's so much art. It's just beautiful. And it looks particularly pretty today because it's so bright and sunny. And summer is such a happy, happy season. You know, as I get older and I look back on so many memories of different passages in life, you know, summer's really kind of a coming of age season, I think. It's a time of firsts. You know, you learn to swim for the first time. You get your first little taste of independence, maybe a first romance. And usually it's when you get your first job, right? What was your first job, Jimmy?
Well, it depends on how far back I go. Probably Little League umpire.
Ooh, that's a dangerous job.
I used to have parents yelling at me, umpires yelling, or actually, not fellow umpires, but fellow coaches and stuff.
Yeah, parents.
Yes.
Yeah, they would be very...
That wasn't a strike. You know, stuff like that.
Kill the umpire. Well, my first summer job was making corned beef sandwiches at McGee's Food Stand in Farmer's Market. It's still there today, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, it was lots of fun. Very tourist-oriented, lots of fun people watching. I didn't mind if I never saw a corned beef sandwich after that first summer again.
Wow.
Yeah, summer jobs are fun. But, you know, this time of year is also that big moment when graduates are looking for their first professional job, you know, their career job. So today on the Call Me Catholic Show, we are saluting all those graduates out there seeking careers. Work is very noble. And it's usually not an option. It's not an option in our house.
No.
You know, Scripture tells us that. Paul, in his letter to the Thessalonians, says, if you don't work, you're not going to get fed. I mean, it seems a little harsh, but it's a good idea.
That is truth.
And that's big, making that first leap toward really supporting yourself, living on your own, making enough money to feed yourself. And let's not forget to bring our Catholic identity with us to the workplace. Not that we need to make a statement of it, you know, or advertise it or proselytize on the job, but if we're Catholic, we should be proud of it, embrace it. It's who we are, and you don't have to leave it at home. In fact, you know, I think sometimes a Catholic high school on a resume or some experience having worked at a Catholic organization really distinguishes your application. You know, Catholic schools are known for providing excellent education. The Catholic Church is known for its heart for service. So it will often, you know, serve you well. I think I only had one experience in my professional life when my faith and my work kind of came together in a potential conflict, but which turned, I was called out as a Catholic, but it actually worked out. You know, I do voiceover work, you know that. And that means that my voice is used to record and animate, narrate scripts and things.
Right.
So I do a lot of work with this one recording studio. And they called me one day and they said, hey, we've got a medical institution, a medical organization that wants to use your voice for their phone prompts. They have an elaborate new patient automated phone system, and they have a big script of prompts. So could you come in and record it? And I said, sure. And they said, there's only one problem. We don't have the script yet. We're not going to get it until the day of the recording. So we'll give you a chance to look over it before you record. So I said, fine, that's no problem. So I showed up at the recording studio and this woman is standing there, the woman I worked with a script in her hand. And she says, Peggy, you're Catholic, aren't you? And I said, yep, I am. And she said, well, I just want you to know, I looked through this whole medical script, and I don't think you're going to have a problem with any of it. And she said, I know that as a Catholic, you have certain belief systems, and I wouldn't want you to have to narrate anything that was contradictory to your beliefs. And I'm assuming she was referring to the church's stand on respecting life at all stages.
Right.
But I was so honored and impressed that she respected my faith enough to know that as a practicing Catholic, Catholic, I wouldn't want my voice to give a message that was, you know, gravely in conflict with my belief system as a Catholic.
Exactly.
So it was a kind of a nice experience, and it made me think, yes, I am proud to be Catholic and not afraid to say it. So today on the Call Me Catholic show, we've got some great guests lined up to help us explore the topic of Catholics in the workplace. Dr. Christine Mugridge will be telling us what it's like to be a correspondent with the Vatican Press Corps. How cool would that job be?
Wow.
That's pretty neat.
Pressure.
Yeah. And then we're going to have a mouse in the house. Sherry Van Meter, one of the first Mouseketeers on the original Mickey Mouse Club, will be our guest, and we'll share the memories of that unique first job. But right now, we have a young man who decided, heck, he was going to start his own business out of college. A noble one at that. Adam Grijalva founded the Skate Connection in 2011. It's a nonprofit organization that promotes inclusion through skateboarding. Welcome, Adam.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Well, I want to hear more about this. I think skateboarding is such a fun, dynamic sport, and the fact that you're using it to be an inclusive tool is really cool.
Yeah. You know, we believe in giving people with disabilities the tools that they need to immerse themselves into the skateboard culture, and so people can view them as skateboarders and, you know, not disabled or retarded.
Mm-hmm. So how do you find each other?
As far as people with disabilities?
Well, yes, how do you find that connection? You know, how do you find the people with disabilities and they all skate together? What's your communication tool to get the word out about it?
Well, it's still pretty grassroots. Okay. A lot of the people that we have were actually our friends from high school. Mm-hmm. We became friends through another nonprofit called Bus Buddies, and these guys became our best friends. And it was hard to hang. We always went out to the movies and mm-hmm. all this, but it was really hard to. Well, he's part of our childhood skateboarding, so it was hard to take them skateboarding with us when they didn't skateboard. Mm-hmm. So we started giving them boards and letting them ride our boards, and then we saw how much they, you know, loved it just as much as we did. So from there, we started talking to other people, and they, you know, those parents knew other parents that wanted their kids to do something. So we just invited, it started out just us inviting a bunch of people with disabilities, a bunch of families at a park, and inviting them and teaching the kids how to skateboard. And that's how it started. It kind of still works that way. I mean, we email here and there, but yeah, it's still more word of mouth in the Southern California area.
And you have a Facebook page, don't
you? Yes, we have a Facebook page, facebook.com/TheSkateConnection.
The Skate Connection, that's what it's called.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, do you find that any of the parents of the young people with the disabilities, are they kind of protective? Do you think they get a little nervous to see their kids? Because skateboarding isn't easy. It's not just like a walk in the park. You have to know what you're doing.
Yeah. The question I love the most from parents is saying, "Oh, what happens if he falls?" And I love just telling them this you know, the straight answer, "Oh, he will fall." Uh-huh. And that's what, you know, we kind of want to bring to people with disabilities is to learn how to fall. That makes you very human. Mm-hmm. Everyone needs to learn how to you know, eat it on the ground and, you know, get back up and dust off. And it's sad to see that in the disabled community when they're so afraid to do anything. Mm-hmm. And kind of, you know, that's I think that creates walls and makes them, you know, disabled. Mm-hmm. And so skateboarding totally breaks that.
Yeah. Well, how do you teach them how to do it? I mean, it's kind of like riding a bike. You have to just kind of let go and let them fly, right?
Yeah. I mean, we have a couple of techniques, and we're more of a come out and just hang out with us, and if you want to skate, you can skate. Mm. You know, if they need help, we do provide help, and we start off holding hands. It's some people are naturals and they just jump on it. People with autism and Down syndrome, they're ridiculous at skateboarding. They're
no fear.
No, they're no fear, and you get them at a certain you get anybody at a certain age, they have no fear and they can just jump on it, you know, and they're good. But when you get older, it's a little harder because, you know, you're kind of aware of yourself, your surroundings, but it's awesome because we're just there to pretty much help them grow.
And you go out to skate parks in Los Angeles?
Yeah, so we have a couple of different programs. We have the our first ones were skate sessions, just inviting all these people to skate with us, skate park to skate park, really trying to be a role model to people and bringing these kids out there. Then we also have free skateboard clinics where we provide the opportunity for people with and without disabilities to skateboard together, just inviting the whole community to get together. We've been in Compton. We do a lot of events in Compton because that's our favorite city to be in.
They're skateboard friendly?
Skateboard friendly, but they really, really, really want something, and it's really nice. Yeah, it's really awesome to see them just love it. And then we do free private lessons, and then during the winter break, this coming winter break, we're going to have a 3-day skate camp as well. So
wow. Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm going to be blunt with you. Sometimes skateboarding has a reputation for being kind of the grunge athletes and kind of sort of sassy and got some attitude out there. Yeah. But, I mean, you're showing it's really all about heart.
Oh, yeah. The skateboarders have the most heart. They're so into skateboarding.
I think you're right. I mean, I've seen that. I have a very good friend whose son is a professional skateboarder, and he has the biggest heart in the world. I mean, he's always reaching out to other people and sharing his sport with them. So I'm going to remind our listeners that if they want to learn more about you, they can go to two things, either Facebook and look up The Skate Connection, or you have a website too, don't you, theskateconnection.org?
Yeah.
Okay. And is there any opportunities for volunteerism or for donation giving? Because I know this is a nonprofit organization.
Yeah, I mean, our donation link is there on the website, and also Facebook can redirect you there. Our volunteer opportunities are more in when we're having the free skateboard clinics, and we keep that updated, and we ask that on our website and social media.
Okay, well, thanks, Adam. Really enjoyed listening to your testimony about this.
Thank you.
You've given skateboarders a great name out there. So look them up on Facebook, theskateconnection.com, and if you want to learn more about it, you can also find them on skateconnection.org, their own webpage. So it's a wonderful way to bring your Catholic identity to the workplace, Adam. Keep up the good work, and God bless you. The Call Me Catholic show is going to take a quick break, but next up, we will talk with former member of the Vatican Press Corps, Christine Mugridge, about her experiences at that very interesting workplace. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is the Call Me Catholic show, and I'm Peggy Normandin. And welcome back to the Call Me Catholic show. I'm your host, Peggy Normandin, and we're talking today about Catholics in the workplace, saluting all those graduates out there looking for their first big career break. Our next guest launched her very successful, accomplished, ongoing career in the Catholic Church with a job that I've always thought would be so cool. She was a member of the Vatican Press Corps for 8 years, where she worked after receiving her doctorate in communications and theology from the Pontifical Salesian University in Rome there. Dr. Christine Mugridge, welcome to the Call Me Catholic show.
Wow, that's a wonderful introduction, Peggy, and thank you for having me.
I think it's kind of a modest introduction with your pedigree, Christine. You have accomplished a lot. Now, you've done a lot in your Catholic career. You've published multiple books. You've founded several nonprofit organizations. You've hosted your own radio show in San Francisco, just to name a few things on your resume. But the Vatican Press Corps is the job that sounds so inside. Is it all that?
Well, there is a diplomacy, yes, and certain channels that you have to work through within the Vatican. However, I'm very glad that you've asked me that question, because I believe that the increase in news agencies via social media is a positive thing, and I want to encourage new social media agencies, news agencies, to have a representative that does contact the Vatican to get press credentials.
Mm-hmm. Well.
It used to be that, for example, the National Catholic Register or one of the bigger news agencies like CNN, they would be the only ones that would have a representative on the ground. But now more people are moving to Rome and living there and working in that beautiful city and collaborating with the Vatican to release different venues of news media.
Well, are you in the Vatican as a Vatican Press Corps member? Are you working inside the Vatican?
Well, you're not a member of the employee staff of the Vatican, no. You are an agent of a particular organization that wants to disseminate news, and you are credentialed then by the Vatican to have special access to papal documents and curia updates and press briefings, and often you'll be getting items under embargo first before anyone else in the world gets them, which recently was something that came in the news because the papal document, the new encyclical on the environment, was leaked by a particular editor of a news agency. So, and that's a big no-no. I mean, there's a lot of the Vatican itself. The Vatican City State is a sovereign nation within the Italian borders. It has different jurisdictions outside of Rome, for example, at Castel Gandolfo. So when you, as a citizen of another nation, enter onto Vatican property, you are a guest. And if you are reporting and if you are close to the Holy Father and you receive items such as a document under embargo, which means it's not released to the general public yet, then you are entrusted with a certain relationship, which does make you part of the way I felt. I was part of the team that was actually serving the Holy Father by accurately reporting and not leaking private information before it was generally disseminated through the Vatican press office itself.
Well, can they trace that leak, like this one from Laudate Si? Can they trace who was responsible for that? I mean, are you held accountable?
Yes, they can, because that agency released it before, and they put it up on their own site. And the journalist that was accredited to releasing it was actually following the call of his editor, who was his boss.
Well, are they now persona non grata with the Vatican Press Corps?
Unfortunately, yes. The Vatican Press Office did indicate that that breach of confidence, which is, it's not a binding contract in the sense that there, I don't believe that there is legal action that the Vatican will be taking against those people, but certainly you don't want to upset the Vatican Press Office if your job is to report on them. You want a good working relationship with them, which is why I'm encouraging newer forms of media, social media outlets especially, that have people speaking about the Pope and the Vatican and the Magisterium and the Curia and things of faith, that they do diligence and do their research and not just give editorial commentary, but actually go into a good, solid working relationship with the Vatican Press Office. John Paul II was the Holy Father that initiated that office himself, and all of the major news agencies from various countries will have someone in Rome. Many of them have their own office right there on the Vatican property established by John Paul II.
Well, you know, because there is such an increase in news reporting outlets, it seems like there's this competitiveness to be the first one to break the story, too. So they will frequently not read something completely. They'll take a little soundbite or a little excerpt, and things are reported on out of context. Have you found that to be a common problem?
Well, yes. In fact, it's an interesting example that I want to cite. When I was reporting for Relevant Radio as their Vatican, their first Vatican analyst and live Rome correspondent. It was unfortunately, it was sadly during the period of death of John Paul II. And at one point, the Vatican had an agency that had credentialed journalists, ANSA, which is a large European news agency, report released that the Holy Father had passed away. And in fact, EWTN reported that the Holy Father had passed away. And I had my editors and my journalists back home in the United States calling me saying, please substantiate this. And I refused because the Vatican itself had not
made the statement.
And what I felt very much, Peggy, and this is where I think personal integrity as a Catholic journalist comes into play with regard to our formation as Catholic communicators. What I felt was very important at that point was the respect for the Holy Father and not to have the scoop, because everyone wanted the scoop to get it out there that he had passed away. And actually, he didn't pass away.
Oh, he hadn't at that point.
It was very touch and go for him. And the very next day, Navarro Walls, who was the official Vatican spokesperson at that time, left the press room in tears and said, you've never seen me like this before, in response to, did the Holy Father die yesterday? What happened? Why was this news reported? So there are times when leaks to get a scoop will happen, or leaks to be, I think, somewhat preemptive in trying to persuade public opinion to have an idea of what your agency, the editorializing bent that you want to take, that all of these different frameworks are there. And thank God I had the freedom to make the call myself. And yes, we are getting more and more aggressive because people are able to utilize something as small as a smartphone to take a photo or to take video. I like to go old school and let the Vatican call the shots on things of great import.
Well, I think that's a very respectful, honorable way to go about it. But the other thing is, I think as people consuming news, we're just reading little headlines that come up on our internet, and the headlines can really be twisted. I notice on my Yahoo page, they always have some things on Pope Francis, and the headlines can be very misleading from what the article or what the, you know, the substance of the story is.
I think that there was an expression that started about 15 years ago regarding news and entertainment that were combined, and the word is infotainment.
Yes.
And I think social media is also swayed by a need for infotainment and or, again, remember this, people that are journalists as a major, they'll understand that an editorializing of the news is really not news. It's commentary. It's personal opinion.
It's opinion, yeah.
But what's happening now is we have a lot of blurred lines. So if you have an editor, regardless of whether it's a particular well-known name of a website like Yahoo's news page, et cetera, that editorial segment will be blurred very often with the information, strict up facts, and especially in our day, sound bites are the news grabbers.
Yeah, right. Well, that's
because we don't have time to read, quote unquote. And also, Peggy, interestingly enough, statistics show that people in younger than under 15 are driving sales, and so media want to appeal with they're the representatives of the different corporations that are advertising. So they want to appeal to a younger audience, and a younger audience uses a smartphone.
Right.
They don't use laptop.
And they read just brief little pieces.
That's right. And then you've got the problem of, is a person that is coordinating the news releases for that day, are they objective? Can they allow the intention of the Holy Father's words to speak for themselves, or do they want to use him? And this Holy Father, like John Paul II, likes to speak from the heart and from the cuff. Pope Benedict XVI was a little more, quote-unquote, Vatican savvy because of his longevity, having been a cardinal in the Vatican working with John.
And he was shyer, too, so he didn't wasn't drawn to the press as much.
Yes, his whole personality, he loved the media, and he was very gentle and very kind-hearted, but he kept his words very confined because he knew the potential of misinterpretation. And unfortunately, and this is just my opinion, but my sense of it is today the world does not necessarily adhere to the tenets of the Catholic faith, and the moral tenets are going to be opposed. And if they can use the Pope to make it look like he is opposing actual doctrine,
they will.
Then they will do it.
Yeah, they will do it. Well, Dr. Christine Mugridge, thank you for taking the time to join us on the Call Me Catholic show. It's been really interesting and fun to talk with you. I love your perspective, and you certainly have a deep well of experience in this area. So I hope you'll join us again. Keep us up to date on your very colorful Catholic career, Christine.
Thank you, Peggy. I'd love to be with you anytime, and all the best to all the listeners.
Thank you. Next up, put on your Mickey Mouse ears, because Sherry Aberoni Van Meter will share memories of her first job as one of the original Mouseketeers from the Mickey Mouse Club show. I'm Peggy Normandin with more to come on the Call Me Catholic show. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Now listen, do you recognize this theme song?
M-I-C-K-E-Y, M-O-U-S-E, Mickey Mouse. Mickey Mouse. Forever let
us hold our banner high, 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 high.
I'm sure it sounds very familiar to our next guest in the studio with us. Sherry Abberoni Van Meter was one of the original Mouseketeers on ABC's Mickey Mouse Club show. Welcome, Sherry.
Thank you so much, Peggy. I'm honored to be on your show.
Well, it's really fun to have you here. Now, I know after the Mickey Mouse Club, you went on to have a very successful career in television and movies, but this was the job that launched you into entertainment. And how old were you when you first got it?
I was 9, but I had done, before the Mickey Mouse Club, I had done small parts on television and modeling as a baby modeling and things like that. And, you know, wearing outfits or cold medicine or whatever they were selling. Oh. And what happened was my brother and I had an agent, and it was the Hollywood Screen Children's Guild. And they got a call one day that they were looking for new Mouseketeers for the second year of the Mickey Mouse Club, which aired on October the 3rd of 1955, right after Disneyland opened on July the 17th, coming up next month. So they got a call that they were looking for new kids, and my brother really was the one they wanted to see because he was older. He was 2.5 years older than me, and he played the drums, and he was a great tap dancer. And so he went and he auditioned for Walt Disney. And Mr. Disney said, "Well, Roy, you're fabulous, you're wonderful, but we already have Mouseketeer Cubby, and he's a drummer and a tap dancer." So
Wait, this is actually Walt Disney.
Oh, this
himself.
Is Walt Disney.
Wow.
Yes. He auditioned a lot of the kids. And so my brother was sharp enough and smart enough to say, "Well, Mr. Disney, if you can't use me, maybe you would like to see my little sister. She can play the trumpet and do a tap dance at the same time."
You can play the trumpet and tap dance.
I could. And so I went, my mom took me to the studio, and I played my trumpet, did my tap dance, almost knocked out all my teeth, but I got the job.
Well, are you playing the trumpet and dancing at the same time?
I was tap dancing.
Wow.
Yes,
well,
I know. I couldn't do that now, but...
Well, did you sing as well?
I did. Afterwards, I sang, and I remember I sang a song called All of Me, which was really a pretty grown-up song.
All of Me.
That's the one. But I had a lisp.
Oh.
And Walt Disney loved my lisp.
Oh.
And he thought it was really, really cute.
It made you precious.
That's exactly what it did, I guess. So I became one of the Mouseketeers on the second year. And they paired me a lot with Cubby and with Moochie. And all these years now, later, 60 years later, Cubby and I are doing shows on the Disney cruise ships.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yes,
and what do you do?
Great?
What's that show look like?
That is a 45-minute show. And we show video of us with Walt Disney and talk about him and our lives as Mouseketeers, what it was like, and what we did after the Mickey Mouse Club, and what we're doing now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure all of our listeners know of the Mickey Mouse Club show, either from reruns or from that effort that they had of kind of rebirthing it,
right.
Which is kind of painful,
right.
But that it was a children's variety show.
Yes.
And it also had talent come on, and they had like little lessons throughout the show.
Exactly.
So it was a very wholesome show. It was kind of ahead of its time, really.
I think so. And it was one of the Mouseketeers likes to use the word didactic. That it was entertaining, and the kids loved it. And I think the reason that it was so successful, so popular, was that all of the little kids could sit in front of their TV, me included, the first year.
It was on every day, too.
Every day on ABC. And we could wear our little plastic Mouseketeer ears that we got at Disneyland, and we could dream that we could be Mouseketeers.
Yeah.
And some kids came on Friday on Talent Roundup Day, and we would make them honorary Mouseketeers. And Cubby and I still do that in our show. We'll bring someone up from the audience and make them honorary Mouseketeers.
Oh. Well, there were some pretty famous people that went through the Mouseketeer Club. So you had like Mickey Rooney, wasn't he one?
Well, no, Mickey Rooney's children.
Oh, Mickey Rooney's children.
Two of his sons,
well,
Mickey
that's right.
And Timmy.
It would be Mickey Rooney's children. I'm sorry
Mickey
about that.
Mickey was a little older.
Mickey Rooney's children, right. But like Annette Funicello.
Annette Funicello and Cheryl Holdridge and Paul Peterson.
Paul Peterson, who I used to have a crush on.
Yes,
he was
Paul
darling.
Peterson. And who else? Johnny Crawford from The Rifleman.
Yeah. So it was a family, really, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And it still is, which is wonderful. That we're still, there's about 7 or 8 of us that get together and do reunion shows at Disneyland or at Disney World. And we are like a family. We're very close friends, and we always have been. But to know someone 60 years and to be singing the same songs and doing the same dance steps, or now at this point trying to do the same dance steps that we did
playing the
originally,
trumpet.
Right? Playing my trumpet and Cubby on drums. But we are like a family, and it's wonderful.
What was Walt Disney like? Do you have a vivid memory of
him? I do. My first memory of other than when I auditioned, my first memory of him that I just love was my mom and I were walking down Mickey Lane at the studio. It was Mickey Lane and Dobie Drive, and that's where the administration building was. And so, and our kind of our play area was in the theater, and we were on the steps of the theater, and my mom and I were walking down the street, and who's walking towards us? Mr. Disney. Mm-hmm. And well, we called him Uncle Walt. We were told to call him Uncle Walt, but that was kind of hard. That was Mr. Disney.
Mr. Disney, yeah.
That was Mr. Disneyland. And he's walking down the street, and I have on my little outfit, the little pleated skirt, my Mary Jane shoes, and my little ivory-colored shirt with my name and big 2-inch letters across my chest. And he looks and he waves and he says, "Mouseketeer Sherry." And I'm just squeezing my mom's hand. And I said, "Oh, mommy, Uncle Walt knows me." And it was many years later. She said, "Honey, he could read."
Oh. Way to burst the bubble, Mom.
Broke my heart. Yeah, I was like, oh, yeah. So the only thing, people say, do you have any bad memories from the Mickey Mouse Club? The only thing bad about it was I'm terrible with names now. Because yeah. I grew up, everyone wore their name in 2-inch letters. And if you don't have
large
a name
tag.
Large. If you don't have a name tag on, I don't know your name. Oh. So that's kind of bad. But other than that, it was such a happy place to be. Mm-hmm. We could be at the studio 8 hours a day by law.
So were you being taught at this time?
Yes,
so you had teachers
yes.
On there.
We had 3 hours of school, 1 hour of recreation and lunch, and then of only 4 hours that we were allowed to be something, either rehearsing or in wardrobe or in front of the camera. So they were very, very careful with us. The Board of Education was wonderful. I don't know how it is now, but at that time, they were so careful with us and took really good care of us. And our moms or some kind of a chaperone had to be with us mm-hmm. while we were there at the studio. And it was great. It was a wonderful, wonderful atmosphere to grow up in.
It was it's almost iconic in that it just epitomized wholesomeness, which is a word we just don't see that often anymore in entertainment standards, you know?
Yeah, you're right.
It was really, as a Catholic, growing up as a Catholic, there was no conflict between your values growing up and what you experienced on the set or what the script read for the
exactly.
day.
Exactly. There was nothing you had to worry about, nothing that my mom and dad had any problems with. And I think I learned from the time I was very, very young that thank God I had the parents that I had mm-hmm. because they taught me that when I go on an audition, if I get the job, it's only for one reason, because God wants me to get that job. It wasn't because I was cuter or smarter or more talented than anybody else.
I know, trumpet, tap
well,
dancing,
that,
I mean,
that was pretty cool. But then on the other hand, if I didn't get the job, it wasn't because I wasn't cute or wasn't special or wasn't funny or whatever they were looking for. It's just that God didn't want me to get that job. And I've remembered that all of my life. Mm-hmm. And so I think I'm semi-normal. My friends and my
still
family.
Adorable.
Yeah, my friends and family would say, "Well, I don't know about that normal." But you know, I think I sort of have my feet on the ground because you know, growing up in Hollywood, I kept that attitude, always knowing it's just a job. Mm-hmm. This is not life and death.
Yeah.
And to a lot of people, it was. It was very important. They had to make the mortgage. You know, my dad brought the bacon home, and my mom cooked it, and it was, mm-hmm. I had a very normal life. We didn't live in Hollywood. We lived outside. I lived in Westchester mm-hmm. and by the LA airport.
By LMU, mm-hmm. too.
Right, where my daughter went to school. And when I wouldn't be working, you know, maybe I would work after the Mickey Mouse Club, you know, I'd do a movie or a TV show, and I'd work for 2 weeks or 3 weeks. Then I wouldn't be working, and so I would go to regular school, to Orville Wright Junior High School or Westchester High School. And then maybe I'd be in school for a week, and then I'd get another job, and I'd be out for a month. So
that kind of fractured your middle school and high school experience. Did that ever bother you?
You know what? It did a little bit. I when I look back now with adult eyes, I kind of see it that I didn't really know everybody. A lot of people knew me, but I didn't know everybody. I didn't.
Yeah, those
make
are formative years, and
right.
your kind of identity was outside
of
the school.
Was outside of it, right? And so consequently, my lifelong friends are the Mouseketeers, and you know,
pretty cool friends to have,
cool
though.
Friends. They are.
That's really neat. And were you involved in the opening of Disneyland?
I was there,
which is now in its 60th year, right?
Yes, that's right. And there'll be a big celebration. Of course, this whole year is a big celebration at Disneyland. But on July 17th, it will be massive. It will be just huge.
And you'll be there.
Yes, yes, yes.
What is your favorite ride at Disneyland?
Oh gosh, this is terrible. But I think I'm going to have to say it's over at California Adventure, Soarin'.
Okay. Well, the Soarin' one. That is pretty cool.
Wonderful.
Everybody loves that one.
Yeah, it is great. But I think I love Space Mountain.
Ooh, daring.
I am. I'm with my grandchildren.
Yeah. I like the Matterhorn.
Oh, I do too. Yeah. That's a good old staple.
So when you go over there, do you get to fast passes to everything because you have your Sherry t-shirt on?
Oh, yeah. I wear my ears. Especially when I'm home doing the laundry. That's when I really wear my ears.
Loud and proud. I heard you have a Mickey Mouse shaped pool.
Yes.
Is that true?
That's true.
The rumor is true.
Yes. One ear is a jacuzzi and the other ear is a walk down barbecue pit.
Well, I love that. Yeah. I mean, you're obviously very proud of this. This was a really great part of who you are, your identity.
It was, and it is, and I think, like you said before, the main reason why I think I'm so proud of it is because it isn't something that you have to be ashamed of, something that you have to say, oh, yeah, she was in that movie. Yeah. I mean, I can proudly, everyone loved the Mickey Mouse Club. I can proudly say, yes, I was a Mouseketeer. I am a Mouseketeer, one of the original. So I don't have to be embarrassed. My grandchildren are thrilled, my children, my husband, my family.
Well, do you have tapes of your shows?
I do.
Oh, so that's really fun pulling them out. Okay, everybody, sit down. We're going to watch Mom.
You're
going
to watch if you want to or not. Got to watch.
Now, Sherry's too much fun to say goodbye to just yet. So we're going to take a break, and we're going to keep her through the break, and when we come back, we'll talk about how Sherry continues to use her time and talents to build up our good Catholic Church. So stay with us. I'm Peggy Normandin, and you're listening to the Call Me Catholic Show on Immaculate Heart Radio. Kids, and welcome back to the Call Me Catholic Show, where we're wearing our Mickey Mouse ears in the studio today to welcome our special guest, Sherry Aberoni Van Meter, one of the original Mouseketeers from the Mickey Mouse Club show, and who went on from there to build a very successful career for herself in television and movies. So today, Sherry, our show is about Catholics in the workplace. But let's talk about how Catholics can use the talents and skills they develop at the workplace to serve and build up our Catholic Church. I know you've done that.
I'm very blessed to do a lot of emceeing for different organizations, for Legatus or for the Order of Malta. But my mission, my big love, is the Norbertines.
Mm-hmm.
The Norbertine Fathers of Orange County are just such a blessing to us here. We're so fortunate to have them right here in our own backyard.
How did you first get to know them?
Well, they were my daughter's teachers at Santa Margarita.
Okay.
We just got to know them and felt such a good, wonderful friendship and just learned so much from them and became very close friends with many of them, with Father Abbott and Father Hugh. And because of their success, because mm-hmm. they have their vocation have been so successful.
And they serve all our parishes
in
Orange County.
They needed to build a new abbey. They just outgrew their old abbey. We couldn't take the chance on losing them, on them having to go out to Riverside or San Bernardino or someplace and try to find land for a new abbey. So we've got the land. They have 327 acres of the most beautiful prime land in Orange County out on the Silverado Canyon, and their work is going on as we speak. They're digging and grading and going to be building their new abbey, and so I put on all of their galas.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my daughter Casey is on staff. She works for them, and I, for many years, I was worked as a volunteer for them. I still am a complete volunteer, mm-hmm. and so we put on a tea that you always come to, mm-hmm. with your beautiful mother. In the springtime and Easter tea, and then we have our gala that is in September, on the last Saturday in September, the Saturday closest to St. Michael's Day.
It's always very successful, too. They are able to raise a lot of money for their incredible, ambitious endeavors, but
yes, it is.
God seems to bless them with what they need, and with you.
Well, thank you.
Because
it's
you
a
have
two-way
really been a great voice
guys.
For them.
As I say, it's my mission. It's my family's mission.
They're a beautiful presence in our community. They really are. Well, Sherry, it's been a ball having you on the show. And thanks for coming into the studio especially and for being our guest on the Call Me Catholic Show. Come back anytime.
I would love to.
Bring your videos. We'd love to see them.
Okay. We can all sit around with ears on and sing.
Well, isn't it? Didn't it go M-I-C-K? See you real soon.
K-E-Y. Why?
Because we like you. M-O-U-S-E.
Good.
Thank you, Sharon.
Bye-bye.
As you listeners know, we always close our show with a chapter in the My Sainted Mother series. We play a recorded conversation with someone sharing a moment, a memory, just a slice of life from their Catholic journey. Today's story is from Frank, who recalls his first job at a Catholic cemetery and how it launched his successful career in advertising.
I had graduated from Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington, in the spring of 2008, and had grown up in Southern California, but was still interested in pursuing a life in the Pacific Northwest. I was interested in pursuing a job in marketing or advertising in the region. I knew there were a lot of creative agencies coming out of the Seattle and Portland area. After graduating with a degree in liberal arts, I had moved to Portland to try and find a job. Had some interviews set up in the fall of 2008. It was a really difficult market. There was a limited time that I could live in that city while looking for a job. And as my time was ending, I saw a job available with the Archdiocese of Oregon as a marketing coordinator for their Catholic cemeteries. I am Catholic. I was raised Catholic. I attended Catholic school my entire life and thought I had a pretty strong understanding of the faith. I was an altar boy. I had attended Vacation Bible School as a kid. I was a lector into college. I was a Eucharistic minister. I had gone on retreats. However, I realized when I was applying for the job, I had no background or understanding of the dying part of being Catholic. And it was coming down to the final weeks before I had to make a decision to either move home or start to pursue a different career path. After a few successful interviews, I was offered the job with the Archdiocese as the marketing coordinator, and I was incredibly excited to have a job, but also to open up this first career out of college with the church. There was certainly a sense of comfort that came with that, knowing that in a city where I had no immediate family, I was going to be working with a community that I'd always been a part of throughout my life. However, a lot of that comfort went away on my first day when I reported to a small stone building in the middle of a beautiful cemetery. I had never been to a graveside service at that point. I was equally excited for my first day of employment after graduation and terrified that I was entering a world that I had very little background in. I was reminded what an important step this is in an individual's life when they begin to plan someone's burial. Expected or unexpected, it is an incredible shock and a life-changing moment for a family or an individual. And we are responsible for this. My job at the cemetery was two responsibilities. One was to go out to the parish community to share the message of what the cemetery's offerings were, the benefits of the Catholic cemeteries, and educate them on the burial process. So there was an education moment for me about really learning about the value and the importance and the sacredness of a Catholic burial. The other part of the job was to work with families and arrange all of the specifics around a burial. In Oregon, there were three Catholic cemeteries, and my position as a marketing coordinator was involved in all three of them. I can remember at one of our cemeteries, there was a very strong Vietnamese population. They were very, very active in the burial process. It was a beautiful ceremony that was not what I had traditionally seen at the other cemetery that I spent most of my time at. It was always an elaborate celebration at the gravesite where there would be a meal and they would, each individual that attended the service would take turns placing a handful or a shovelful of dirt on the grave and take an active role in the burial process. And as an employee, we were always instructed, be present but not involved. However, in the Vietnamese community, we were invited as employees to honor this person. And sharing in their meal with them at the graveside, placing a handful of dirt, I loved that I felt their grief and shared their grief with them. I can recall on every Friday, one of our frequent guests would be a gentleman who would always bring flowers to his bride. That's what he called her. They'd been married for many years, and she passed away early, and yet he would visit every Friday and bring her flowers. And we knew him by name, and we would greet him, and we'd have a vase ready. And it was a community that I realized was so important for those individuals that had lost someone. I worked for the Archdiocesan Cemeteries in Oregon for just over 2 years. It was such an enriching period, and now I am working in advertising and marketing in Portland. I am employed at a very growing and successful ad agency, and yet I will always have the cemetery to thank for that, because they helped ground me starting out in those formative career years. And whenever I share my resume, everyone stops and says, let's talk about the cemetery. What was that about? And they're curious. They're interested. They see Oregon Catholic cemeteries and they say, I want to hear about that. I don't want to hear about your other agency experience. And it's so fun and enriching to share about that experience, because it has become what I thought was just a job to help me sustain a life in a city I wanted to live in. It has helped me grow my career and gave me an incredible background into what a professional environment is, and also how to live a Catholic identity at work.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons. What do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
Well, Jimmy G, first jobs aren't always exactly what we expected, but they usually set us on our way toward the career God intends for us, don't you think?
Yeah, I have fond memories of my earliest jobs.
Yeah.
I do.
Work is noble. So good luck to all you graduates out there seeking employment. God bless you. And God bless you, Jimmy G, for getting us through another edition of the Call Me Catholic Show.
Back at you, Peggy. Great program.
Thanks. Well, hey, if you'd like to share your comments or questions with us, you can email us a little note at peggy@callmecatholic.com. I'll look forward to hearing from you. But mostly, I look forward to bringing you another show next week, same day, same time, with more good news from our good faith. So until then, I'm Peggy Normandin, but you can call me Catholic.